Talks Abdu'l-Bahá delivered at Greenacre. 16 August 1912. Talk at Greenacre, Elliott, Maine. Notes by Edna McKinney. Every subject presented to a thoughtful audience must be supported by rational proofs and logical arguments. Proofs are of four kinds. First, through sense perception. Second, through the reasoning faculty. Third, from traditional or scriptural authority. Fourth, through the medium of inspiration. That is to say, there are four criteria or standards of judgment by which the human mind reaches its conclusions. We will first consider the criterion of the senses. This is a standard still held to by the materialistic philosophers of the world. They believe that whatever is perceptible to the senses is a verity, a certainty, and without doubt existent. For example, they say, "Here is a lamp which you see, and because it is perceptible to the sense of sight, you cannot doubt its existence." "There is a tree. Your sense of vision assures you of its reality, which is beyond question." "This is a man. You see that he is a man. Therefore, he exists." In a word, everything confirmed by the senses is assumed to be as undoubted and unquestioned as the product of 5 multiplied by 5. It cannot be 26, nor less than 25. Consequently, the materialistic philosophers consider the criterion of the senses to be first and foremost. But in the estimation of the divine philosophers, this proof and assurance is not reliable. Nay, rather, they deem the standard of the senses to be false, because it is imperfect. Sight, for instance, is one of the most important of the senses, yet it is subject to many aberrations and inaccuracies. The eye sees the mirage as a body of water. It regards images in the mirror as realities, when they are but reflections. A man sailing upon the river imagines that objects upon the shore are moving, whereas he is in motion and they are stationary. To the eye, the earth appears fixed, while the sun and stars revolve about it. As a matter of fact, the heavenly orbs are stationary, and the earth is turning upon its axis. The colossal suns, planets, and constellations which shine in the heavens appear small, nay, infinitesimal to human vision, whereas in reality, they are vastly greater than the earth in dimension and volume. A whirling spark appears to the sight as a circle of fire. There are numberless instances of this kind which show the error and inaccuracy of the senses. Therefore, the divine philosophers have considered this standard of judgment to be defective and unreliable. The second criterion is that of the intellect. The ancient philosophers, in particular, considered the intellect to be the most important agency of judgment. Among the wise men of Greece, Rome, Persia, and Egypt, the criterion of true proof was reason. They held that every matter submitted to the reasoning faculty could be proved true or false, and must be accepted or rejected accordingly. But in the estimation of the people of insight, this criterion is likewise defective and unreliable. For these same philosophers, who held to reason or intellect as the standard of human judgment, have differed widely among themselves upon every subject of investigation. The statements of the Greek philosophers are contradictory to the conclusions of the Persian sages. Even among the Greek philosophers themselves, there is continual variance and lack of agreement upon any given subject. Great difference of thought also prevailed between the wise men of Greece and Rome. Therefore, if the criterion of reason or intellect constituted a correct and infallible standard of judgment, those who tested and applied it should have arrived at the same conclusions. As they differ and are contradictory in conclusions, it is an evidence that the method and standard of test must have been faulty and insufficient. The third criterion or standard of proof is traditional or scriptural, namely, that every statement or conclusion should be supported by traditions recorded in certain religious books. When we come to consider even the holy books, the books of God, we are led to ask, who understands these books? By what authority of explanation may these books be understood? It must be the authority of human reason, and if reason or intellect finds itself incapable of explaining certain questions, or if the possessors of intellect contradict each other in the interpretation of traditions, how can such a criterion be relied upon for accurate conclusions? The fourth standard is that of inspiration. In past centuries, many philosophers have claimed illumination or revelation, prefacing their statements by the announcement that this subject has been revealed through me, or thus do I speak by inspiration. Of this class were the philosophers of the Illuminati. Inspirations are the promptings or susceptibilities of the human heart. The promptings of the heart are sometimes satanic. How are we to differentiate them? How are we to tell whether a given statement is an inspiration and prompting of the heart through the merciful assistance or through the satanic agency? Consequently, it has become evident that the four criteria or standards of judgment by which the human mind reaches its conclusions are faulty and inaccurate. All of them are liable to mistake and error in conclusions. But a statement presented to the mind, accompanied by proofs which the senses can perceive to be correct, which the faculty of reason can accept, which is in accord with traditional authority and sanctioned by the promptings of the heart, can be adjudged and relied upon as perfectly correct, for it has been proved and tested by all the standards of judgment and found to be complete. When we apply but one test, there are possibilities of mistake. This is self-evident and manifest. We will now consider the subject of love, which has been suggested, submitting it to the four standards of judgment and thereby reaching our conclusions. We declare that love is the cause of the existence of all phenomena, and that the absence of love is the cause of disintegration or non-existence. Love is the conscious bestowal of God, the bond of affiliation in all phenomena. We will first consider the proof of this through sense perception. As we look upon the universe, we observe that all composite beings or existing phenomena are made up primarily of single elements, bound together by a power of attraction. Through this power of attraction, cohesion has become manifest between atoms of these composing elements. The resultant being is a phenomenon of the lower contingent type. The power of cohesion expressed in the mineral kingdom is in reality love or affinity, manifested in a low degree according to the exigencies of the mineral world. We take a step higher into the vegetable kingdom, where we find an increased power of attraction has become manifest among the composing elements which form phenomena. Through this degree of attraction, a cellular admixture is produced among these elements which make up the body of a plant. Therefore, in the degree of the vegetable kingdom, there is love. We enter the animal kingdom and find the attractive power binding together single elements as in the mineral, plus the cellular admixture as in the vegetable, plus the phenomena of feelings or susceptibilities. We observe that the animals are susceptible to certain affiliation and fellowship, and that they exercise natural selection. This elemental attraction, this admixture and selective affinity, is love, manifest in the degree of the animal kingdom. Finally, we come to the kingdom of man. As this is the superior kingdom, the light of love is more resplendent. In man, we find the power of attraction among the elements which compose his material body, plus the attraction which produces cellular admixture, or augmentative power, plus the attraction which characterizes the sensibilities of the animal kingdom. But still beyond and above all these lower powers, we discover in the being of man the attraction of heart, the susceptibilities and affinities which bind men together, enabling them to live and associate in friendship and solidarity. It is, therefore, evident that in the world of humanity, the greatest king and sovereign is love. If love were extinguished, the power of attraction dispelled, the affinity of human hearts destroyed, the phenomena of human life would disappear. This is a proof perceptible to the senses, acceptable to reason, in accord with traditions and teachings of the holy books, and verified by the promptings of human hearts themselves. It is a proof upon which we can absolutely rely and declare to be complete. But these are only degrees of love which exist in the natural or physical world. Their manifestation is ever according to the requirement of natural conditions and standards. Real love is the love which exists between God and His servants, the love which binds together holy souls. This is the love of the spiritual world, not the love of physical bodies and organisms. For example, consider and observe how the bestowals of God successively descend upon mankind, how the divine effulgences ever shine upon the human world. There can be no doubt that these bestowals, these bounties, these effulgences emanate from love. Unless love be the divine motive, it would be impossible for the heart of man to attain or receive them. Unless love exists, the divine blessing could not descend upon any object or thing. Unless there be love, the recipient of divine effulgence could not radiate and reflect that effulgence upon other objects. If we are of those who perceive, we realize that the bounties of God manifest themselves continuously, even as the rays of the sun unceasingly emanate from the solar center. The phenomenal world, through the resplendent effulgence of the sun, is radiant and bright. In the same way, the realm of hearts and spirits is illumined and resuscitated through the shining rays of the sun of reality and the bounties of the love of God. Thereby the world of existence, the kingdom of hearts and spirits, is ever quickened into life. Were it not for the love of God, hearts would be inanimate, spirits would wither, and the reality of man would be bereft of the everlasting bestowals. Consider to what an extent the love of God makes itself manifest. Among the signs of His love which appear in the world are the dawning points of His manifestations. What an infinite degree of love is reflected by the divine manifestations towards mankind. For the sake of guiding the people, they have willingly forfeited their lives to resuscitate human hearts. They have accepted the cross to enable human souls to attain the supreme degree of advancement. They have suffered during their limited years extreme ordeals and difficulties. If Jesus Christ had not possessed love for the world of humanity, surely He would not have welcomed the cross. He was crucified for the love of mankind. Consider the infinite degree of that love. Without love for humanity, John the Baptist would not have offered his life. It has been likewise with all the prophets and holy souls. If the Bab had not manifested love for mankind, surely he would not have offered his breast for 1,000 bullets. If Baha'u'llah had not been aflame with love for humanity, he would not have willingly accepted 40 years' imprisonment. Observe how rarely human souls sacrifice their pleasure or comfort for others. How improbable that a man would offer his eye or suffer himself to be dismembered for the benefit of another. Yet all the divine manifestations suffered, offered their lives and blood, sacrificed their existence, comfort, and all they possessed for the sake of mankind. Therefore, consider how much they love. Were it not for their love for humanity, spiritual love would be mere nomenclature. Were it not for their illumination, human souls would not be radiant. How effective is their love! This is a sign of the love of God, a ray of the sun of reality. Therefore, we must give praise unto God, for it is the light of His bounty which is shown upon us through His love which is everlasting. His divine manifestations have offered their lives through love for us. Consider, then, what the love of God means. Were it not for the love of God, all the spirits would be inanimate. The meaning of this is not physical death. Nay, rather, it is that condition concerning which Christ declared, "Let the dead bury their dead." For that which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. Were it not for the love of God, the hearts would not be illumined. Were it not for the love of God, the pathway of the kingdom would not be opened. Were it not for the love of God, the holy books would not have been revealed. Were it not for the love of God, the divine prophets would not have been sent to the world. The foundation of all these bestowals is the love of God. Therefore, in the human world, there is no greater power than the love of God. It is the love of God which has brought us here together tonight. It is the love of God which is affiliating the East and the West. It is the love of God which has resuscitated the world. Now we must offer thanks to God that such a great bestowal and effulgence has been revealed to us. We come to another aspect of our subject. Are the workings and effects of love confined to this world, or do they extend on and on to another existence? Will its influence affect our existence here only, or will it extend to the everlasting life? When we look upon the human kingdom, we readily observe that it is superior to all others. In the differentiation of life, in the world of existence, there are four degrees or kingdoms: the mineral, vegetable, animal, and human. The mineral kingdom is possessed of a certain virtue, which we term cohesion. The vegetable kingdom possesses cohesive properties plus the power of growth, or augmentative power. The animal kingdom is possessed of the virtues of the mineral and vegetable, plus the powers of the senses. But the animal, although gifted with sensibilities, is utterly bereft of consciousness, absolutely out of touch with the world of consciousness and spirit. The animal possesses no powers by which it can make discoveries which lie beyond the realm of the senses. It has no power of intellectual origination. For example, an animal located in Europe is not capable of discovering the continent of America. It understands only phenomena which come within the range of its senses and instinct. It cannot abstractly reason out anything. The animal cannot conceive of the earth being spherical or revolving upon its axis. It cannot apprehend that the little stars in the heavens are tremendous worlds vastly greater than the earth. The animal cannot abstractly conceive of intellect. Of these powers it is bereft. Therefore, these powers are peculiar to man, and it is made evident that in the human kingdom there is a reality of which the animal is lacking. What is that reality? It is the spirit of man. By it, man is distinguished above all other phenomenal kingdoms. Although he possesses all the virtues of the lower kingdoms, he is further endowed with the spiritual faculty, the heavenly gift of consciousness. All material phenomena are subject to change. All material organisms are captives of nature. None of them can deviate in the slightest from the laws of nature. This earth, these great mountains, the animals with their wonderful powers and instincts cannot go beyond natural limitations. All things are captives of nature except man. Man is the sovereign of nature. He breaks nature's laws. Though an animal, fitted by nature to live upon the surface of the earth, he flies in the air like a bird, sails upon the ocean, and dives deep beneath its waves in submarines. Man is gifted with a power whereby he penetrates and discovers the laws of nature, brings them forth from the world of invisibility into the plane of visibility. Electricity was once a latent force of nature. According to nature's laws, it should remain a hidden secret. But the spirit of man discovered it, brought it forth from its secret depository, and made its phenomena visible. It is evident and manifest that man is capable of breaking nature's laws. How does he accomplish it? Through a spirit with which God has endowed him at creation. This is a proof that the spirit of man differentiates and distinguishes him above all the lower kingdoms. It is this spirit to which the verse in the Old Testament refers when it states, "And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness." The spirit of man alone penetrates the realities of God and partakes of the divine bounties. This great power must evidently be differentiated from the physical body or temple in which it is manifested. Observe and understand how this human body changes. Nevertheless, the spirit of man remains ever in the same condition. For instance, the body sometimes grows weak. It becomes strong or stout. Sometimes it grows smaller or may be dismembered. But there is no effect upon the spirit. The eye may become blind. The foot may be amputated. But no imperfection afflicts the spirit. This is proof that the spirit of man is distinct from his body. Defects in the body or its members do not imply defects in the spirit. This leads to the accurate conclusion that if the whole body should be subjected to a radical change, the spirit will survive that change. That even if the body of man is destroyed and becomes non-existent, the spirit of man remains unaffected. For the spirit of man is everlasting. Sometimes the body sleeps, the eyes do not see, the ears do not hear, the members cease to act. Every function is as inactive as death. Nevertheless, the spirit sees, hears, and soars on high. For it is possessed of these faculties which operate without the instrumentality of the body. In the world of thought, it sees without eyes, hears without ears, and travels without the motion of foot. Without physical force, it exercises every function. This makes it evident that during sleep, the spirit is alive, though the body is as dead. In the world of dreams, the body becomes absolutely passive, but the spirit still functions actively, possessed of all susceptibilities. This leads to the conclusion that the life of the spirit is neither conditional nor dependent upon the life of the body. At most, it can be said that the body is a mere garment utilized by the spirit. If that garment be destroyed, the wearer is not affected, but is, in fact, protected. Furthermore, all phenomena are subject to changes from one condition to another, and the revolution caused by this transformation produces a form of non-existence. For instance, when a man is transformed from the human kingdom to the mineral, we say that he is dead, for he has relinquished the physical form of man and assumed the condition of the mineral substances. This transformation or transmutation is called death. Therefore, it follows that no phenomenal organism can be possessed of two forms at the same time. If an object or phenomenon presents a triangular shape, it cannot simultaneously possess the shape of a square. If it is spherical, it cannot at the same time be pentagonal or hexagonal. In order to assume any given figure or form, it must relinquish its previous shape or dimension. Thus, the triangular must be abandoned to assume the square. The square must change to become a pentagon. These transformations or changes from one condition to another are equivalent to death. But the reality of man, the human spirit, is simultaneously possessed of all forms and figures without being bereft of any of them. It does not require transformation from one concept to another. Were it to be bereft of one or all figures, we would then say it has been transferred to another. And this would be equivalent to death. But as the human spirit possesses all the figures simultaneously, it has no transformation or death. Again, according to natural philosophy, it is an assured fact that single or simple elements are indestructible. As nature is indestructible, every simple element of nature is lasting and permanent. Death and annihilation affect only compounds and compositions. That is to say, compositions are destructible. When decomposition takes place, death occurs. For example, certain single elements have combined to make this flower. When this combination is disintegrated, this composition decomposed, the flower dies as an organism of the vegetable kingdom. But the single elements of which the flower is composed do not suffer death, for all single elements are permanent, everlasting, and not subject to destruction. They are indestructible because they are single and not compound. Thus, they cannot disintegrate or become separated in their component atoms, but are single, simple, and therefore everlasting. If an elementary substance is possessed of immortality, how can the human spirit or reality, which is wholly above combination and composition, be destroyed? Nay, rather, that spirit, which is all in all, is a unit and not a compound. Its destruction, therefore, is not possible. The spirit of man transcends the qualities and attributes of any natural element. It is greater in attributes than gold, silver, or iron, which are single elements and indestructible. As they are free from destruction and qualified with permanence, how much more so is the human spirit free and immortal? How will that ever be destroyed? This is a subject of great importance. There are innumerable proofs in support of it. I hope we may continue it at another time. Before we leave, I desire to offer a prayer in behalf of Miss Farmer, for verily she has been the founder of this organization, the source of this loving fellowship and assemblage. O thou kind God, encircle these servants with the glances of thy providence. Set aglow the hearts of this assemblage with the fire of thy love. Illumine these faces with the light of heaven. Enlighten these hearts with the light of the most great guidance. O God, the clouds of superstitions have covered the horizons of the hearts. O Lord, dispel these clouds so that the lights of the Sun of Reality may shine. O Lord, illumine our eyes so that we may behold thy light. O Lord, attune our ears so that we may hear the call of the Supreme Concourse. O Lord, render our tongues eloquent so that we may become engaged in thy commemoration. O Lord, sanctify and purify the hearts so that the effulgence of thy love may shine therein. O thou kind Lord, bestow quick recovery through thy power and bounty upon the founder of this association. O Lord, this woman has served thee, has turned her face toward thy kingdom, and has established these conferences in order that reality might be investigated and the light of reality shine. O Lord, be thou ever her support. O Lord, be thou ever her comforter. O Lord, bestow upon her quick healing. Verily, thou art the clement. Verily, thou art the merciful. Verily, thou art the generous.